Avi on Money, 12 to 1 p.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome to 101.9 High FM. It's 6 minutes past 12. Thanks so much for joining us. As promised you last week, I must say I took a bit of a flyer there. I wasn't quite sure we had secured Wayne, but it gives me great pleasure to welcome Wayne McCurry from now First National Bank Investments, Wealth and Investments.
Wealth and Investments, yes.
There
thank you.
There you go. Wayne, welcome back to the studio.
Thank
and
you.
Thanks for making the time available.
Sure.
Good. Let's get straight into it. I've been waiting for a while to pick your brain on a few topics. Let's start with what we always talk about and have a global macro view of what's going on. The settling period of President Trump has settled down.
Mm.
That's now a given. The world has moved on. And there's lots of things happening in the meantime. For some people, they're positive. Some people, they're not so positive. But the bottom line is the American markets are strong.
Yes.
What – paint that picture for
okay.
us. Put us in perspective.
Well, let's go a little bit back to 10 years ago, the global financial crisis.
Right.
Now, we were very lucky in South Africa. Sometimes it's nice to be a little bit isolated because we didn't really feel the full effects of that. Obviously, we felt it. But I can promise you it was almost catastrophic overseas. And the world's economy was in such a precarious situation. I mean, the banking system literally almost failed. And what happened to stabilize is that the American central bank and central banks in the whole developed world cut interest rates to zero. I mean, effectively to zero. And equally as important, they flooded the market with money. And that was the so-called quantitative easing. Now, lucky enough, I'm not an economist. Quantitative easing is just a very fancy word for printing money. They printed money out of fresh air. And as I said, I'm an accountant. And as far as I can work out, central banks are the only institution in the world that can pass a one-sided journal entry. They can just create money out of fresh air. So what they did was they literally went around and bought up all the bad assets. All the bad loans, all the bad debts from the banks. They just bought them and gave them money. Then they also went in heavily into the bond market, mainly the government bond market, but not exclusively so, and just created this enormous demand for bonds. They just bought bonds. So as a consequence of that, the banks were flooded with liquidity, so they didn't go bankrupt. The short-term interest rates were cut to zero. And the long bond, i.e. the long-term interest rate, was brought down significantly. So the short-term rates went to zero. The long bond went to, call it, 1.5%. And the banks were full of liquidity. So you saved the housing market because interest rates went down. You saved the banks because they were flooded with liquidity. And you saved anyone with debt because the cost of servicing that debt just plummeted. In other words, the world's economy was saved. Now, 10 years later, the world's economy is actually quite a good place. It's recovered quite nicely, etc., etc. Now interest rates are going up.
Before we get there,
sure.
Let's just take a quick break and then we'll be back with you in a moment.
Avi on Money, 12 to 1 p.m. only on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back to 101.9 High FM. It's 10 minutes past 12. Thank you so much for joining us. If you've just joined us, we have the honor of having Wayne McCurry in studio, and we are going to be discussing everything from macroeconomics down to the specifics of the South African economy. But Wayne, you were saying just before the break
yes.
that we've recovered quite nicely since 10 years ago.
Recovered, yeah. The world's economy has recovered, and now we're in, let's call it the late cycle, where interest rates are going up, both long-term and short-term, and inflation's going up. But then just to come back to the share market in America in particular – share markets love cheap money and free money. They love it. It's what drives share markets up is cheap money. So if you're a US investor and you're looking at making an investment decision, you can buy a long bond. Well, first of all, you can leave your money in the bank and earn 0.25%. So that's not good.
Not exactly attractive.
You can buy a long bond and earn 1.5%. It's better than 0.25%, but it's still not good. Or you can put your money in the stock market and earn a 2.5% or 3% dividend. What you're going to do? You're going to put your money in the stock market.
But what's interesting there is you said dividend. We're not talking about returns
not return,
on investment.
Just divvies.
Okay. So in other words, the profit that you're getting from holding
your
that
payout.
Share.
Yeah, payout. The payout you get from holding the share is significantly higher than what you will earn in the bank and if you had to buy a government bond. So as a consequence, we have had a raging bull market in America for 10 years. The S&P 500, which is the main index you can look at, man, my numbers might be slightly wrong, but I think it's up from 800 or 900 or something like that to 2,900. I mean, it has been a phenomenal run because the conditions were fantastic. You had low interest rates, you had a recovering economy, and there was plenty of liquidity around. So share market went up.
Why did it only go up, though, in the last 150, maybe 200 days? Prior to that, it was quite mute.
No, we've had a proper bull market now for a long time, for 10 years. We've had a proper bull market. And, of course, it was the emergence of the so-called FANG shares. So that's Facebook, Google, Netflix, the new age shares. They also propelled it forward quite a bit. But now the stock market's in a more difficult phase. And it's quite simple. The cost of money is going up. The economy is still doing well. So make no mistake, the U.S. economy is still growing well. The European economy is actually recovering quite nicely. China is still growing at 6, 7%. Emerging markets, excluding South Africa, unfortunately, also still growing quite nicely. India is growing quite nicely. But unfortunately for the share markets, the cost of funds, money is going up. So now as an investor, you can say, well, the U.S. long bond is now 3%, 3.1 or something, and the dividend yield on the share market is now only 2%. So now you sit with a dilemma. I can earn 3% in the bank and take no capital, or 3% in a bond and take no capital risk. Well, the capital risk is the U.S. government.
Fair enough.
Or I can buy shares at 2% and take all the capital risk that the share market is. So now the investment decision is not as clear-cut as what it was 10 years ago. And that's why I think we've seen a little bit of weakness on the share market, and I'll come back to that. And, you know, one thing I've learned about investments, which you know as well as what I do, you know, no one knows the future. I don't know what's going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen. But the one thing I'm quite confident in saying is that the big run up, the big bull market, is very mature, and the best days are probably behind us. I'm not saying it's going to collapse. There are very, very valid and very significant reasons as to why this time around, and I hate those words, but why this time around it's slightly different to other market collapses. So when you look in 2002 and in 2008 and in 1992, even 1997, the conditions were similar. You had a very strong economy, but you had rising interest rates.
Right.
And we all know what happened then. The market fell, let's call it on average, 50%. I don't think that's going to happen this time around because there simply are not the same level of excesses in the economy. There's not nearly as much debt from individuals or from companies. There's also not nearly as much credit expansion. There's also not nearly as much as inflation isn't rising nearly as much as what we've seen in the past. So I don't think we are on the cusp of what has happened in the past. But understand, the conditions are still similar. It's just the extent of the conditions are far more muted. In other words, you cannot expect a major equity bull market to continue because the underlying fundamentals that drove the market up have in fact changed.
Isn't it also a positive thing that we've been through the 2008, 2009, we've been through the accounting crisis, let's call it that, and that therefore the reporting at the beginning is a lot more accurate. People are being a lot more careful with where they report. We'll get to the Stanhope debacle a little bit later.
Yes.
But we're not dealing with inflated figures. We're not dealing with the nonsense that we had in 2007, 8, and 9, where we weren't quite sure what was going on.
Yeah, look, every time around, I mean, we dealt with the financial services bubble in 1994 overseas. We dealt with the dot-com bubble in 2002. We dealt with the, let's call it the leverage bubble or the global financial crisis in 2008. Each bubble is different. So we won't get any more accounting scandals this time, but there'll be something else. Maybe it's the social media shares. Maybe it's the the Tesla shares. I mean, I don't know, but each time around, a different part of the market rises significantly and then takes pain as the cycle changes. So the accounting is much better. Banks' balance sheets are in significantly better shape. They can't bet with their own money anymore, right, because the rules have changed. But each time around, something different comes along. So we haven't escaped any form of consequence of having a rising interest rate cycle or a late cycle development. We haven't escaped that. So something else will be different this time around. But at least what we have now is, let's call it, the danger signs are significantly less dangerous. Interest rates are still rising, but because inflation isn't going up wildly as we've seen in the past, interest rates don't have to go through the roof. I mean, for argument's sake, the U.S. long bond on all previous occasions went over 5%. This time around, maybe 3 is the level, maybe 3.5 is the level. Short-term interest rates, similar. Inflation, very similar. Inflation, you know, I doubt very much whether it'll go much above 3%. But it's still rising, and interest rates are rising, and that's not good for the share market. So once again, to come back to what I said earlier on, it's more than likely the best days of the U.S. bull market are probably behind us.
In South Africa, if we had to translate that back here briefly, we've got an issue where the days of the market, sort of the bull market's over. We've got rising interest rates, which means that the opportunity of earning interest on your money with very little risk is getting better.
Correct, yes.
And we've got a market where we've got maybe more volatility coming in. You know, if you look back 3 years, it's been a rough time for the South African equity market. Mm. 2016, the best performing asset class was cash.
Yeah.
If you're sitting in cash now, you're not doing too badly.
You're not doing. Well, look, I mean, our market's been moving sideways now, as you said, for 3 or 4 years. And in the last while, since the ANC election, we had a little mini bull run. But it seems to be sort of petering out a little bit now. But within that, there are... Well, maybe let's talk about our share market. It's called the South African share market or the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. It's not related to Johannesburg or South Africa. It's the first thing people must realize. People often say, ooh, this happened in South Africa. Why didn't the share market fall? You know, it's not a South African share market. So just roughly speaking, 60% of our share market are global companies that have virtually nothing to do with South Africa. They just happen to be listed on our stock market for historic reasons. So that's 60%. Another 20% are mining companies. Now, some of their operations might be in South Africa. A very small proportion might be in South Africa. But their fortunes are still determined essentially by the dollar price of the commodity they sell. It's not determined by what happens in South Africa. It's a very indirect influence. And then the residual 20% is South African shares, which is dominated by banks and retailers. Absolutely dominated by those two sections. So only 20-25% of our share market is actually South Africa. Now, since the ANC election, that's the part of the market that's run because it did so badly the previous 3 years.
Wayne, we need to explore that a little bit further. Let's take a quick break. We'll be back with you guys in a moment.
Avi on Money, 12 to 1 p.m., only on 101.9 High FM.
Welcome back to 101.9 High FM. It's exactly 21 minutes past 12. Thank you so much for joining us. If you've just joined us, in studio we have Wayne McCurry from FNB Wealth and Investment. And if you've been with us, thanks so much for listening. Please keep the SMSs coming in. I'm not promising to get to all of them because they are coming in thick and fast, but I will try to ask them to Wayne as they come in. And some of you, so on that note, let me just recap basically what we've been discussing up until now. Wayne has had to quickly run out to take an emergency call, so I will recap what we're discussing up until now. And basically is that since 2008, 2009, we've had a very, very strong market all over. Money has been cheap, money's been flooding into the markets, and the main reason for that is that the dividend yield that you could get on a share, in other words, the profit from a share, not from the price movement, but from the profit that was paid out to you, was 2.5-3%, which was maybe 2.5% more than you can get in putting your money in the bank, where you would maybe get a 0.25%. Yes, there was no risk, but the opportunity cost in shares was far greater. And that's why money flooded into the market. And that's why the market had been so buoyant up until now. What we were about to discuss was why we in South Africa did not really participate all that much in the tremendous bull market that happened overseas. We know that in the last 3 years for South African investors, it's been a very, very torrid time. It's been very difficult. There's almost been no safe haven to go to. I remember clearly the 2008, 2009 crisis. There were certain fund managers who had certain funds that, regardless of how aggressive they were, but some of them were very aggressive, they did very, very nicely. And they were able to keep your head above water. Algeria able to get better returns there that you could have got on the interest rates over a certain period. But interest rates were also higher than they are now. So now we've got this double whammy of relatively low interest rates, which is good for those who are indebted, but very poor for those who need to live on the investments on a fixed interest rate. So that's the challenge that we have now, and that's something that I want to discuss with Wayne when he comes back into studio. But just to give you a bit of a heads up as to what we're going to be discussing, is I want you to look at specifically at two specific shares, one being Steinhoff and one being Dis-Chem. Steinhoff, simply because I really want to try and unpack a little bit as to how that thing went so sour, so quickly, so catastrophically. And the next thing is that if you look on certain websites, it's there every day as one of the most viewed shares. So Steinhoff, for example, at the moment is trading at 1.69 rand, and 35.5% of all shares viewed has been that Steinhoff share. But what I've just noticed now with the latest update is that the share is actually not trading. So that's something else I want to discuss with Wayne. The other share that I'm wanting to discuss is Dis-Chem. Dis-Chem is currently running at 28.84 rand, and that is at the moment nearly 2%, 1.9% down. There was an interesting comment that came out of Dis-Chem earlier on yesterday and earlier later last week, and I don't want to talk out of turn, and therefore I'm going to wait for Wayne just to understand exactly what happened there and how that worked. The other one that seems to be recovering quite nicely is Capitec. Capitec, 857.56 rand. We know that is a sterling share, but took a bit of a hammering with a bit of a rumor that came out. So we need to look at that also. But the all share as we speak is 0.25% up at 57,963, and that's where we stand currently at the market. But to elaborate a little bit more and to get into the meat of it, Wayne, if I can put you in the hot seat immediately.
Sure.
I want to come back to where we were, but I since rambled on. Let's talk a little bit about Steinhoff.
Yes.
I've just noticed now that as I'm looking at the markets that it's not trading. It was trading this morning, but I see it's not trading now. I don't know if that's just because the update hasn't come through. But it's sitting at 1.69 rand.
Yeah. Well, look, quite frankly, it's impossible to know what Steinhoff is worth. So let's just go back to the whole Steinhoff story. I mean, we all know the background to this. And I must say, I personally have known Marcus Juster for many, many years. You know, as a business associate, you can say I've interviewed him on quite a few occasions and been to quite a few of his company results presentations. And to be honest, I didn't think he would have pulled this. And that was my opinion, but clearly I was wrong on that one. Right, so we still don't know what Marcus has done, but we know he's inflated profits and inflated asset values and caused a catastrophe in a major listed company. That's just about all we know. We know that there were rough estimates that everything he's got up to was to the tune of about 6 billion euro, but the latest update we got said that it's bigger than that. Maybe it's 9 billion euro. So in other words, he inflated assets or inflated profits and or inflated profits by anything between 6 billion euro and 9 billion euro. We don't know exactly where, how, what happened, but the share price has dropped from 100 rand to 1 rand.
Wayne, let's just go back. I mean, I don't think either of us have done auditing for many, many years.
I've even got an accountant.
The basic principles of auditing: an asset is there. You verify the asset. How do they get it so wrong?
Well, it's intangibles. It's valuation of royalties. It's valuation of companies. There's a whole lot of things. I mean, clearly the auditors didn't do their job properly, and I mean, that's quite obvious. But, you know, to be totally honest, neither did the independent members of the board do their job properly, because from what I can ascertain, they knew nothing about this. This was as big a surprise to them as what it was to everyone else. Ask Christo Visser. I mean, he's lost 50, 60 billion rand on it.
And I listened to Christo Visser's interview that he gave quite recently, yes, where he was spitting mad,
yes,
to say the least. And something in me, maybe something naive, something immature, something inexperienced,
yeah,
kept saying, but sir,
you
come
were there.
On.
You were the chairman.
Come on.
Yeah. Then I get you on that one. Now I get you on that one. So, yeah, look, he clearly didn't know what was going on. Otherwise, he would not have sold his Pepkor, which is a fantastic company, into Steinhoff.
It was his baby.
It was his baby. And he would have sold ShopRite into Steinhoff had this deal not, had this news not broke. He would also have sold ShopRite for Steinhoff shares. So clearly, he was betting. I mean, I'm just giving a rough number now, but let's call it 70 billion rand of his own money that he'd built up over his lifetime and was prepared to take Steinhoff shares. So he didn't know what was happening. Maybe he should have known, and he will carry responsibility as the chairman, as will all the directors, for not finding this out. They didn't. They clearly didn't do their duties properly. But let's put that aside.
Okay. Right.
Let's talk Steinhoff again now. We know the extent of the hole, whether it's assets or profits. It's somewhere between 6 and 9 billion, but that's not the real problem.
Euro.
That's not the real. The real problem is they will be in court for the next decade, because every person who lost money on Steinhoff will sue them. We've seen GT Ferreira. We've seen the previous owners of Takitown. We've seen Christo himself suing the company. Because the argument is so simple. I bought your shares based on the information that you put out about your company. That information was intentionally wrong. It was lies. There were scandals in that. So therefore, I based my decision to buy your shares on false information that you supplied, so therefore I can sue you for every cent that I've lost owning your shares. And that's not all the tax authorities suing them. That's not anyone else, any other statutory body, any other register of companies, any other infringement of the Companies Act, or any other legal infringement that you've made. You are going to be sued for... I don't even know. That's the problem. I don't even know how much. But they can sue you for maybe even 20 billion, 25 billion, maybe even with penalties and exaggeration, maybe even 30, 40 billion euro. Whether they get it or not, or how much they get, I don't know. But that's what you can't work out about Steinhoff. So even when the auditors eventually come and tell us, this is actually what did happen. These are what the assets are worth. This is the profit, what the profit should have been. You don't know the extent of this outstanding liability, civil, criminal liability for legal fees. You got no idea how big that is, and you got no idea when it's going to be resolved. Just as a rough background, when you take other calamities, Enron, other yes, corporate calamities, the total value paid out eventually by these companies and their insurers and their third-party liability, whatever you want to call it, turned out in the region roughly of about 15 or 20% of the market capitalization of the company before the scandal broke. And Steinhoff's current price is way lower than that 15%. Understand that 15% is just a number, because all we got to go on is what happened in cases like Enron, etc., where there was a similar set of circumstances. But you do know is 10 years later, this will still not be sorted out. It's going to go on forever.
Very simply, you and I, average Joe in the street, had a unit trust.
Yes.
Unit trust was invested in Steinhoff.
Correct.
They've taken that pain.
Yes.
Who are they going to sue?
Well, we'll be joining, all the people who own Steinhoff will be joining the class action suits like GT Ferreira, like Tacky Town, like Christo Visser, to say, you presented false information to us and we made our investment decision based on that false information, so therefore you owe us this money. Oh no, there'll be plenty. I think virtually every institutional shareholder and virtually every shareholder will join a class action suit, because it doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to employ the lawyer. You just sign the piece of paper and some other person fights for you, and then they, if you win something, they take a proportion of that payout.
And just to mention, the Maswabni will be done by way of what they call a negative audit. In other words, you'll have to sign if you don't want them to represent you.
Yes.
So that, don't panic about that. Like, well, if I don't sign, therefore it won't. It's going to go ahead.
I don't know about that, but look, it's going ahead, yeah.
Who are they going to sue?
They're going to sue the company and the directors and anyone who was involved in this fraudulent activity. How much you get out or not, I don't know. Now, let's take the independent directors,
right,
including Christo. There's some big names there. A couple have left, but there's some big names there. And they are in their own right very wealthy individuals, and they're all going to be sued. It doesn't matter whether you're guilty or not. You were negligent in your performance as a director. So even if you knew nothing and weren't involved, you still carry liability. Now, every company carries insurance against that. So it's the insurers of those of the company that will eventually have to pay out. The company itself will have to see what assets there are. There are some good assets. Eh? The Pepco they bought, overseas, that's untainted by this, because they only bought it a few months before this broke. So that's untainted. So that's worth, that's an asset you can sell. The Pepco they bought in South Africa, they combined with a few other Steinhoff entities and listed a separate company called Steinhoff Africa, or STAR, Steinhoff Africa Retail. That company looks untainted. And Steinhoff, although they have sold some shares in STAR, they still own. So there are some assets, but unfortunately, we don't know. The assets might be worth way less than the liability, because we've been told they've got debt of 10 billion euro.
Isn't it a case of maybe slaughtering the goose that lays the golden egg? If you liquidate the company,
yes,
then everybody loses.
Everyone loses, and that's why they've had quite a few meetings with their bankers and their bondholders, because they issued quite a few bonds in the market. Now, those bonds are currently owned by the European Central Bank and these so-called vulture funds that love buying bonds at 10 cents in the rand, and then let's see what happens. And they've had lots of meetings with them and their bankers, and the bankers know this. So they say, if we liquidate now, we get zero. If we defer the debt, maybe convert the debt, maybe change the payment terms, we might get 10 cents, we might get 20 cents, we might get 30 cents. You know, 30%, 30 cents in the rand payment of the debt. So they will allow Steinhoff to continue, because if you close the doors, then there is truly no value.
Wayne, before we go into another topic, just to come back to this, Marcus Huerster, you know, it's very clever in hindsight. I never met the man, I've never been to a presentation, but maybe I have the luxury of the arrogance of looking back and hearing what I want to hear. Was almost a dictator. The man was untouchable. Could do what he liked.
People thought he was truly a wizard. He could create value. I mean, that's why Christo backed him. That's why lots of very senior people, lots of very wealthy people, lots of people in high positions in, let's call it corporate or finance South Africa, actually backed Marcus. They loved him. He made them, in theory, a lot of money. Of course, the biggest example, as we've discussed, there is Christo.
The bottom line, if we look at other companies, is that a warning light to look at, where you've got a CEO who sort of rides above the wave?
Yes. Yes and no. Listen, there aren't too many meek and mild characters who've made billions of rands over
Fair
the
enough.
Years. Okay. Now, to be truly a success in business, I mean, effectively, you've got to be quite aggressive. You've got to be an unusual person. You've got to have a bit of an ego. You know, you and I don't run multi-billion rand corporations.
And I don't want to back a wuss.
Yeah, exactly right. So understand, if you are politics as well. If you're a really good politician and you, I mean, you probably a tough character because it's a tough world out there. Yes. And you've almost got to be in the top 5% to be successful. So having an ego and being quite frankly, probably a bit of a tough character is not unusual for a successful CEO. But we have learned some things from Steinhoff, and hopefully it can help us into the future. Watch out for companies that do many, many, many acquisitions with debt. Watch out.
So highly geared companies.
Highly geared companies, and also the number of acquisitions. They're just doing one after the other, after the other, after the other. That's first point. Second point is watch out for companies that somehow restate their financial statements because this has changed and that has changed, and we've had this, we now made this big acquisition, so we're reorganizing our reporting clusters, and we used to have clusters based on country, but now we're doing clusters based on business type. Watch out for many accounting reshuffles, corporate events. But of course it's easy with hindsight.
Let's go into another one. It's a household name. Steinhoff wasn't a household name.
No, it wasn't. No.
The stuff in their stable was.
Yes.
Alpha Corp, Tech Town, Pep Corp, da, da, da. But if you go to Dis-Chem, everybody knows Dis-Chem.
Everyone knows Dis-Chem.
And it's almost like a mushroom. It's arrived from nowhere.
Yes.
You know, if you and I look back, like, I'm trying to think, like, where? Remember the first time I heard the name, I thought, that's got a daft name for a pharmacy.
Yeah.
But it's now become a family name. They listed a while ago, and they had a bit of a wobbly last week. What is that all about?
Look, they have – okay, let's just go back to Dis-Chem. Why right. I like Dis-Chem. I like it because they have – forget the share price and all of this. They have a very loyal customer base. People love Dis-Chem. The customers like going there, and they also like the products that they sell, the pricing point that they've sold, because they've been eminently successful in what they're doing. Another reason why I really like them is that they can expand their product range massively. I mean, I don't go to Dis-Chem often, but on the times that I've been there recently, you can now buy very, not exactly my style, but very sort of health-orientated TV dinners.
Yes.
They didn't have that a while back. You can now buy fluffy slippers and shoes. And so they're expanding their product range because they have an incredibly loyal customer base for to sell their products to. So it's not dissimilar at all to Woolworths 15, 20 years ago. They also expanded their customer base. And it's not dissimilar to Discovery. Discovery also got a very loyal customer base. So you started selling medical aid, now you sell insurance, now you sell investments, now you've got a bank opening up. So it's the same business model, and I think Dis-Chem can continue to do this. Why they took a bit of a wobble is that they've expanded their stores quite significantly. However, if you just compare what's called store-for-store sales or like-for-like sales, numbers were a bit soft there. Now, there is an element of cannibalization. You used to go to the Dis-Chem 5 kilometers away from you, but now there's one 2 kilometers away. You're going to that one.
Correct.
So you're still spending money at Dis-Chem. So part of the new store sales is sales that they've robbed from the old store. But there's also a new customers in that new area they've opened up to, because now you'll go to Dis-Chem rather than going to Clicks or to the local pharmacy. But the market was a little bit disappointed about that.
So there was nothing, there's no anomalies there, nothing to worry about.
I don't think so. I don't think there was anything to be, you know, overly concerned about that number. And certainly they have done well. And, you know, maybe do a bit of investigation, do a bit of analysis of it. But maybe it's not the worst time to consider buying the share after what is clearly a good company, where the share price does have a little bit of, as you said, a wobble, because at least then it gives you an opportunity to possibly go into the company at a more reasonable price.
Now, at the end of the day, the price as I'm sitting now is R28.99. It's down 1.4%. Interesting, Steinhoff is trading again, sitting at R1.68, and that's down 0.6%.
Yeah, I think the high there was R96, eh, in Steinhoff, or something like it.
Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I just want to read a message from a listener. And we'll be back in a moment.
Avi on Money. 12 to 1 p.m. Only on 101.9 Chai FM.
Welcome back to 101.9 Chai FM. It's 18 minutes, nearly 17 minutes to 1. And unfortunately, often the best conversations happen in the 30-second breaks between on the advert breaks, between the discussions that we have live on air. But just as I said to you, to read out a SMS that came through, quite short, bottom line, colon, greed, and a whole lot of exclamation marks.
Yeah.
But that's the bottom line that drives it. It's greed and fear.
Yeah,
and
that's
the two things.
And greed, which you want the share price to go up, and then when something goes wrong, it's fear, and the share price gets destroyed. So there's nothing wrong. Ultimately, greed is capitalism. So if you believe capitalism works, then you must believe in greed. People were greedy. They wanted a high return. But that's the same reason why you bought Naspers, same reason why you buy any share.
Absolutely.
The same reason why there's any investment is ultimately greed.
And just talking about that, a index that I look at every single day, and I think, Wayne, I heard about it from you many, many years ago, is CNN's Fear and Greed Index on their page. It's on the bottom right-hand side of the page where you've got the stock market. So you're going to the normal page, you're going to money, and then you're going to markets on the bottom right-hand side. And that, for me, is a very comforting thing to look at. At the moment, it's sitting at 56, so it goes from 0 to 100. 3 weeks ago, we were deep in the red. We were in deep fear. That all had to do with the trade issues, the war that came up with President Trump. That's now sort of worked itself out the system to some extent.
To some extent, yeah. There was good news on that, yes.
War or promises or war saber rattling is always good for the markets, and that seems to have pushed it up a little bit, but that's also it's come off a bit. But it's sitting at 56 at the moment, so that just gives me a sense of comfort that I want to have clients screaming at me in the next week while the equity markets have come down a little bit. Wayne, as usual, we're running out of time. One thing I want to discuss with you is you mentioned just before we had a break that 20% of our shares are mining shares in South Africa.
Yes.
Where do we stand with mining in South
Africa? Mining looks fantastic. Mining had, and this is not South Africa now, mining had a terrible time because of oversupply from 2011 through to 2015. 12, call it 2016, 2015, 2016. They had a terrible time. They produced too much and the prices plummeted. Then they almost all went bankrupt, surprisingly enough. So they cut back costs. They cut back on high cost production. They cut supply and the price went up. And the price hasn't gone up significantly. I mean, roughly speaking, let's use oil. Oil in the China years was $150 a barrel. It fell to $30 a barrel when the world collapsed, and now it's at $80 a barrel.
Right.
So it's about halfway to where it was in the China years, just roughly speaking. At the moment, though, because the mining companies have cut expenses so significantly, they have never, and never is a very long time, they have never had as much free cash flow. So not only are they making a lot of money on their product, they're not spending any capital. Because they were so burnt last time they spent capital because they overproduced that they're not spending any capital now and they're making profits because they cut all of their terrible operations, they slashed the costs, they cut everything back. They have never produced as much free cash flow as what they're doing now. So the mining situation's fine, and you read Barlow results. Mining companies are spending money again. In fact, they can't get the yellow equipment quick enough from Caterpillar because everyone in the whole world mining now, after almost going bankrupt, as I said, 3 years ago, they now got so much money and they haven't spent any. So now they've got to watch out because if they don't spend now, they'll have nothing to sell in 10 years' time.
Is it a time to buy Barlow Wool then?
Probably yes, yeah.
Looking here and I've seen before Northern Platts.
Platinum's very different.
Okay. I said, and South 32 also.
South 32 is actually doing quite well at the moment. South 32 is aluminium and coal.
Right.
So it is a mining company, but it's not sort of, you know, deep level mining. It's and the slight negative on South 32 is that they have relatively short life of mine. So in other words, unless they do something, they're going to run out of the mine. They're going to have nothing left to mine in 8 years or 10 years, where it's normally a life of mine. The average that any mining company's got is probably 20 years. So they are They've got to spend money now to increase their capacity. Platinum's very different. There's one mine, and that's owned by Anglo American, that's actually making money at this price of platinum and palladium and rhodium. Everyone else is negative cash flow and losing, and companies like Lonmin are probably the worst of the whole lot, because the platinum price is way below the average cost of production.
How are they going to survive?
You just hope, and two things. The world needs platinum and palladium, and there is clear demand. There's just too much supply. So then the second thing comes, they've got to cut the high-cost supply. But now, because that's all in South Africa, it's so difficult to cut something here where jobs are at stake.
Absolutely.
Because you run into massive, massive, not just government, but social pressure. I mean, you could, and I'm inventing this number, but I don't think it's far off. If all the mines tomorrow had to close their loss-making shafts, this is now all the mines, maybe 50,000 jobs will be lost, 40,000 jobs will be lost. Imagine how that would devastate the platinum belt. You know, so it's difficult. So they have cut back. The South African mines are probably producing 1 million ounces less than they did 10 years ago, but it's still not enough. There's still oversupply. And we all know that in life, you cannot continue spending more than you earn. So at some stage, you get to a point where, well, you've got to do something. And at the moment, it costs the mines more to produce an ounce than what they can get when they sell it.
And we're talking specifically about platinum.
Well, the platinum group metals, the PGMs, yes.
Okay. Then, as usual, we're running out of time. So I just want to quickly, you know, go to the last issue, which is saying it's been bouncing around. And I want to know if it affects the market, people's investments. This whole issue of land that's come up. I want to clearly state, you know, nail my colors to the mast. Land in South Africa is more than a theoretical issue. It's a real issue. We have landless people. We have tremendous discrepancies in the past where behavior was that people's land was stolen from them, as simple as that. Something has to be corrected.
Something's got to happen.
But at the end of the day, we're sitting in 2018, we're running modern economies, we're running modern societies. There needs to be a common ground. The reality, should South Africans liquidate everything they've got and just sit on cash, because who knows if your house is going to be taken away?
Yeah. Okay, look. The problem with all of this is we don't know. And to be honest, I don't think the government knows what it's going to do. Otherwise, we would be told, because make no mistake, the new president understands the uncertainty that this issue creates in society and in markets and with foreign investors. So it is terribly unfortunate that we don't know the details. We know it's coming. There can be no debate that we are not going to see some form of accelerated land distribution. We have a few pointers, and let me run through a couple of them. First of all, this is not about property, it's about land. So they're not going to come and get your company expropriated from you. There was great concern at one stage somehow that the word property expropriation without compensation meant all property. It's not. It's land. Second thing is, it's not just agricultural land. In fact, as far as I can ascertain, the main problem is actually rural, urban land.
Correct.
That's the main problem, is that people live too far from work. I mean, that's what it boils down to. It's not a wanting to own my hereditary farmland. It's people. It's so expensive for people to go to work and back, and it's so hard to find a job when you live 50, 60 kilometers away from where there's work. So the main driving factor here is want housing near jobs, not out in some apartheid era township, out far away from where there are job opportunities. So understand that it's not about the mealie farm or hereditary land. It's actually land in cities. The third thing, and the most important thing, it will depend on who you believe and who you trust. The new state president has said clearly on numerous occasions, there is not going to be wholesale land grabs like Zimbabwe. He has also stated it will not threaten food security, and he has also stated it will be done in a responsible manner that does not create chaos and mayhem. So, do you believe what he says? I do. So I'm not overly concerned about this, even though I know it's coming. If you don't believe the state president, then that's your story. One other thing I can say is that prepare yourself for two things that are going to happen until we have clarity on this. You are going to hear scare stories here from many, many people, friends, media. You're going to hear Zimbabwe. So just get ready for it. And we've heard it already. There's been lots of people out there saying, we are Zimbabwe, and this land issue, we Zimbabwe. So just prepare yourself for it. These are scare stories. Okay. Second thing is, you're going to hear from the other side of the spectrum, you're going to hear stories, we coming to take all. We coming to take everything you own in your house. And just prepare yourself. These are fringe elements that you must ignore. And just on that, even though a lot of media have said the ANC / EFF alliance on this land story, it is not an EFF thing. This is driven clearly by the ANC, and clearly within the ANC by the president. It's not driven by Julius Malema and the EFF. This might have been one of their pillars of their manifesto that they bring, but they're not controlling this process. The ANC is controlling the process, and within the ANC, the state president is controlling this process. So ultimately, it'll depend on whether you believe him or not. It's as simple as that. But until we get more clarity, and as I said early on, I don't think the ANC's got clarity in this, but until we get more clarity, there's uncertainty around. Understandably so.
And big business isn't panicking?
No, but business is definitively not panicking. In fact, business confidence is very high.
Wayne, as always, thank you so much for coming in.
Pleasure.
Thank you for your time. I hope I got everybody's SMSs. If not, you know how it works. Please email me or SMS me directly, and we'll get your questions answered. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week. Enjoy the brisk, chilled weather that we've got. It's always good to have a bit of a change. We'll speak to you next week.